Good morning.
Good morning, Sensei.
If I hold up this object and I ask, what is it? What is this? Most people will say, Sensei, that's a stick. Or some people might say, it's the root of an apple tree. Or someone else might say, no, Carl, that's a vine. But actually, the reason that I hold up this stick is because I want to introduce each of you to the universe, to the source. And when I talk like this, some people will not understand, and they'll say something like, what are you talking about? The universe? It's a stick. Just a stick. Or some people might say, that sounds like a lot of spiritual crap, Carl. Knock it off. So what is it that prevents us from seeing that this stick, right here, stick, is the entire universe, and I'm holding it up before you right now? So let me answer, or at least begin to answer this question by reading a poem by Peter Levitt from a book of poems entitled 100 Butterflies. Already at birth, I was parted, not just from my mother, but body from mind, mind from its source. That's why I take up this soft blade of breath to cut me back into one. Now, if you think about it, the womb is a place of oneness, of intimacy. And when we leave the womb, we enter the world of form and begin a lifelong induction into duality. And how does this induction take place? Well, a helpful way to understand this is to look at some of the ways we develop both biologically and psychologically. One of the most rapidly developing parts of a newborn is its brain. And research shows that a newborn starts thinking even before they learn to speak. Babies as young as 5 months old make distinctions and categorize certain types of events. The nature of this categorization changes and gets more sophisticated with age. As the child's learning evolves, he or she is introduced to a variety of names, concepts, identities, hierarchies, goods, bads, etc. And this process continues throughout elementary school, high school, college, and then in life in general. This process contributes to a view of the world as dualistic, a world of this or that. From a psychological perspective, one of the major developmental tasks of childhood, which was identified by none other than Erik Erikson, is the separation and individuation phase. This is the process where the child separates from the parents and develops an independent identity. This identity is me and mother, me and father. And this separation and individuation process further contributes to the sense that we live in a dualistic world of me and you, this and that. Thinking also plays a large part in the way we see the world and experience ourselves in relationship to it. Researchers estimate that we have between 3,000 to 5,000 thoughts per day. Now, when I read that, I thought, wow, that's a lot less than I thought. The frequency and the content of these thoughts create what we call reality. It's as the existentialists say, we are what we think. So let me share a few examples of how thinking affects our perception of ourselves and the world around us. I recently read an article about how surgeons are trained to be very careful of the conversations they have during surgery, even though the person is under anesthesia. And the reason for this is that research shows that negative suggestions, such as an offhanded comment like, ooh, he's a real bleeder, or she's going to have a tough recovery, These suggestions, these negative suggestions, are heard subliminally and can have a pronounced negative effect on the outcome of surgery by the negative thoughts that they produce. Similarly, stress management programs focus on how participants self-talk about their circumstances, how the self-talk contributes to their understanding or their experience of their circumstances. This attention to thoughts is based on research which shows that negative self-talk heightens stress, disrupts appetite, either causing over or under eating, and disturbs sleep. The conclusion of the researchers confirms what meditation teachers have known for a long time, that our thoughts create our reality. A simple example. Take two runners, runners of equal ability, and through some quirk of fate, they both break their leg. So neither one of them can run. One runner, his self-talk is, "This is the worst thing that could possibly have happened. I'm not going to be able to run. This is terrible. How long is it going to be before I can run? I don't know if I can go on like this. Running is so important to me." The other runner says, "Oh boy, this sucks, but you know what? Maybe this is an opportunity to work on that book that I've been thinking about for years." So one runner has a negative perception of this experience of the broken leg, and the other has a positive experience, an interpretation, a positive way about talking about it in their heads. The experience that each one of these people have will be very different going through the process of healing. And one last example comes out of the world of psychotherapy, working with couples in particular. And frequently, one couple will say to the other one, "You made me feel angry. You made me feel worthless." So an example of how this might happen is the husband comes home late from work. And she's angry with her husband because he made her feel angry and made her feel worthless. And so if I were to ask the wife to recall that specific time when this happened and to notice what she was thinking, she might say something like, "Well, you know, I thought to myself, this is the third time this week that he's come home late. I don't think he loves me anymore. I don't think he values me anymore." And those thoughts produce anger, sadness, shame, produce feelings. The thoughts produce feelings. And then in the session, I'll ask her to ask her husband, "Well, are you staying home because you don't want to be with me? Are you staying home because you don't love me anymore?" And often what will happen, the other partner will respond, "No, but I was concerned that my job was in jeopardy. And I wanted to look good with my boss. I wanted to look like a contributor. I wanted to have value in the workplace." So it wasn't the action on the part of the partner that caused these feelings. It was thoughts. It was the thinking. Now, you can go on and on about this and say, "Well, why didn't he tell her, you know, and all that?" And then there's truth to that. But the point isn't that. The point is that without checking it out, the partner was, the woman in this relationship, was having all sorts of feelings produced by thinking. And it's another example of how thinking creates our reality. And of course, when this happens, the next step is to check it out. And if it turns out that, like in this instance, which is a real instance, the guy was worried about his job and he decided he better stay, he better not go home, even though he knew his wife needed help at home, they had two young kids. So it would not be unreasonable, though, for the husband to be asked to see how easy it would be for his partner to have these kind of thoughts if he doesn't communicate to her what he's doing, what his intentions are. So even in relationships, the way we are with each other, the way we communicate with each other, can create fertile ground for certain types of thoughts which are detrimental to our relationships. So these are a variety of examples of how powerful and persuasive thought is, and how it affects our perception of reality. So if I'm repeatedly creating negative thoughts, I'm going to live in a negative reality. This thought-created reality will affect my relationships, as I said, my health, my sense of being in the world. So getting back to the stick. If I pick up this stick and I just see a stick, I will be demonstrating an incomplete understanding of what it is that is before me. Of course it is a stick. Yes, it is a stick. But it is also a non-stick. That is, empty of any particular identity. When we realize it is not limited to the identity assigned to it by our thoughts, we realize its universality. We realize its non-dual relationship with the universe. We realize its oneness. It's our thought producing that makes this stick appear as an individuated item and makes it impossible for us to see that it's part of everything, that this is the universe, this is a representation of the universe. But because of our thinking, we don't see it that way. To conclude, if we just live in a reality created by our thoughts, a dualistic reality, we will be out of balance. We need the soft blade of breath to help us re-experience the oneness and intimacy we knew before we became separated from the source. We need the practice of zazen to help us still our mind and to open the doorway back to this source. But even this is not an end to our journey. Because we don't want to lean in the direction of empty oneness either. We don't want to not see this as a stick. We must be moderate and be centered, not leaning or holding to either expression of reality. Just form and emptiness dancing inseparably with each other. Let me just end with a few words from Rumi. Be empty of worrying. Think of who created thought. Why do you stay in prison when the door is so wide open?